and welcome to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, August 7th, 2022. I'm your reader, Sharon Falduto, and from the front page of today's Gazette, UI Healthcare offered $605 million to buy Mercy Iowa City by Vanessa Miller of the Gazette in Iowa City. Among four proposals Mercy Iowa City entertained last year in its search for a partner, was one from University of Iowa Healthcare, offering over $605 million to take ownership of the community hospital and make it the centerpiece of a new UIHC community division. The landmark deal, if it had materialized, would have ended a 137-year, at times contentious, separation dating to 1885, when UIHC's founding medical department split from the Sister of Mercy Catholic Order due to different priorities. And it would have struck at the heart of recent concerns aired by community hospitals in eastern Iowa, including Mercy Iowa City, that UIHC increasingly aims to veer out of its advanced care lane and compete with them for primary and secondary care patients. When a state-funded academic and medical institution crosses the line into providing the same primary and secondary care service, which are provided by community hospitals, it threatens the continued existence of other providers. It reduces patient choice and access to care, and it creates an atmosphere or an environment of distrust among possible collaborators, Sister Helen Marie Burns, a Mercy Iowa City board member, told the State Health Facilities Council last August during a hearing to consider a UIHC proposal to build a new hospital in North Liberty. Suresh Gunaskaran, then the chief executive officer of UI Hospitals and Clinics, at the state hearing rejected the idea his hospital's expansion would threaten community health care. "There are numerous possible ways that we can collaborate with all community hospitals. It won't change the need for North Liberty," Gunaskaran said, "because North Liberty is really going to be focused on tertiary and quaternary care." The council eventually approved that project, which UIHC initially disclosed as a $230 million, 300,000-square-foot facility at the corner of Forever Green Road and Highway 965, and later revealed was a 469,000-square-foot multi-building project, now costing more than $525 million due to inflation. But just about 3 weeks before that hearing, on August 6, 2021, UIHC submitted a proposal to take over Mercy Iowa City and initiate a new division focused on community care. "We believe that UI Healthcare is the ideal partner for Mercy Iowa City," according to the university's proposal, which was obtained by the Gazette. "Our goal is to combine the resources of UI Healthcare's comprehensive integrated delivery network with the unique local strengths of Mercy Iowa City to expand the scope of care and improve access." UIHC said it planned to launch a community hospital division, separate from its academic divisions, centered on Mercy Iowa City, which would remain a hub for primary and secondary care in the region with its own local governments and board. "Unlike others, we see Mercy Iowa City not as simply another asset in our portfolio, but as the centerpiece of a new community of division," according to the proposal. The deal never materialized, according to an email Mercy officials sent employees just over a week ago, reporting they received and vetted several offers in response to the July 2021 request for proposals, but failed to identify a good long-term fit and would remain an affiliate of Mercy One. Last year, both Mercy Iowa City and Mercy One said they wanted out of that partnership. The Des Moines-based Mercy One, to which Mercy Iowa City pays an annual $2 million management fee, cited the hospital's historical operating challenges, the impact of the pandemic, and the changing healthcare dynamics in its decision at that time to cut ties. Documents obtained by the Gazette show that in addition to UIHC, Mercy Medical Center in Cedar Rapids, Unity Point Health, and Marshfield Clinic Health System of Wisconsin offered to take over Mercy Iowa City. Mercy Iowa City officials didn't answer the Gazette's questions about why the four partnership proposals didn't pan out, calling those decisions proprietary and confidential. The board, Mercy Iowa City, and Mercy One leaders are legally bound by non-disclosure agreements with all those who were potential partners. Therefore, we cannot legally confirm, deny, or share any information about proposals or names, Mercy Iowa City spokeswoman Lisa Steigletter said. "It is important for you to know that the Mercy Iowa City board reviewed the proposals, narrowed down the potential partners, and ultimately did not find a partner who was a good long-term fit." Mercy Medical Center President and CEO Tim Charles told the Gazette conversations are ongoing with Mercy Iowa City. "We viewed ourselves as a potential partner in finding a solution to the current challenges that Mercy Iowa City is facing," he said. Of course, arriving at a structure for a relationship can be challenging. That said, I can confirm that we are in conversations but can't discuss specific details. Mercy Cedar Rapids' motivation, in part, was the importance of preserving community health care in and around Johnson County. We believe that there is a constituency within these communities that has long valued the ease of access, quality of care, and intimate experience that Mercy Iowa City is able to provide, Charles said. However, over time, we have also watched the efforts of UIHC to diminish Mercy Iowa City's capacity and ability to continue its essential mission. Iowa has 124 hospitals, including 88 of the smallest critical access hospitals, 4 rehabilitation or long-term care hospitals, 15 characterized as rural or rural referral, and 22 urban hospitals, which are the largest in the state's bigger cities. In appealing to their Mercy Iowa City in their partnership proposals, Mercy Cedar Rapids and Unity Point Health highlighted the need for strong community hospitals and support of Mercy's mission. Mercy Medical Center President Charles told the Gazette, "Clearly, there continues to be an essential role for Catholic healthcare, as institutions like ours are rooted in values that are committed to ensuring that all individuals have access to healthcare, including the sick and the poor. We believe that the community needs an alternative," he said. "Employers need an alternative. It has been demonstrated many times over that when communities are reduced to a single hospital, the cost of healthcare increases and the level of service decreases." So, from the front page, farmers still recovering 2 years after derecho. USDA has paid over $380 million in derecho relief funds in Iowa, by Tom Barton of the Gazette Des Moines Bureau in Marion. If one looks hard enough and knows where to look, one can still see evidence of the lingering damage from the 2020 derecho that flattened billions of acres of crops, crumpled grain bins, leveled sheds, topped silos, and tore off barn roofs. Nearly 2 years removed from the August 10th, 2020 storm with hurricane-strength wind gusts, most Iowa farmers are back on their feet, but some are still recovering and rebuilding their operations, with some toppled and damaged farm buildings still in disarray. Marion farmer Wayne Blackford and his family farm about 1,700 acres of corn and about 1,100 acres of soybeans, and before the derecho, they fed about 1,500 to 1,600 head of cattle each year. Today, that number has been cut roughly in half as the family works to rebuild its operations. "We had cattle on 11 farms before the derecho," Blackford said, noting the family is no longer feeding cattle on 3 of the farms, and cut down a fair amount on other farms, but still have 200 stock cows, and we have the calves from them. The family lost not only crops, but also several cattle barns, sheds, garages, and silos. Some, including a cattle barn, machine shop, and maintenance shed at the family's main farm off County Home Road, have been replaced, while others still lie on the ground. "Financially, the storm didn't do us too bad," Blackford said, noting commodity prices remain strong. "Of course, grain prices have gone up too, and that's been a big, big help." Crop building insurance covered a bulk of the cost of damage and losses, but cleanup has been slow, Blackford said, noting the massive undertaking to recover from the storm that produced wind gusts of an estimated 140 miles per hour in some places. "Just the time involved to clean up everything," Blackford said, adding that it's been a lot of work. "If we put all of our buildings in one spot, they'd cover 80 acres, he said. The derecho leveled 4 silos and blew away a couple of grain bins at the main farm in Marion that have not been replaced. We just burnt and burnt and burnt, and I don't know that the fire went out for 30 days, Blackford said of the initial cleanup of storm debris at the farm. In some places closer to town, the family decided not to rebuild damaged farm buildings. Other sites remain a work in progress. The buildings are still there. They're just lying on the ground, Blackford said. We're going to clean them up slowly, but we've got another building site. We got it about half cleaned up last year, and we pretty well got it cleaned up this year. That would give us 2 more years, at least, for cleanup efforts." And turning to the Iowa Today and the Week in Iowa, a recap of news from across the state. Under the heading In the News, Abortion Reaction, Iowa abortion rights activists were energized by the results of a Kansas vote on Tuesday, where voters roundly rejected an amendment to the state constitution that would have removed abortion protections. Iowa activists said the results show that efforts to restrict access to abortion are unpopular in even deep red rural states. Republican lawmakers in Iowa have passed a similar amendment to Iowa's constitution that would remove abortion protections. If the resolution passes the legislature again in 2023 or 2024, it would go before voters in November 2024. Ernst changes burn pit vote. After facing criticism from veterans groups and Democrats, U.S. Senator Joni Ernst, Republican Iowa, voted to support the Honoring Our Pact Act, which extends health care and disability benefits to millions of veterans exposed to toxic burn pits. Ernst had previously joined a group of Republican senators to oppose the bill over a budget provision, but Ernst and Senator Chuck Grassley both supported the bill on Tuesday, which passed 86-11. Maquoketa Caves Murders. The Cedar Falls family killed at Maquoketa Caves State Park on July 22nd died of gunshot wounds, stabbing, and strangulation, according to autopsy results released Thursday. Tyler Schmidt, 42, died from a gunshot wound and multiple sharp force injuries, meaning stab wounds. His wife, Sarah Schmidt, 42, died of multiple sharp force injuries, and their daughter, Lulu, 6, died from a gunshot wound and strangulation, the Iowa Department of Public Safety said Thursday. The Schmidt's son, Arlo, 9, survived the attack. The Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation said the evidence shows Anthony Sherwin, 23, of La Vista, Nebraska, entered the family's tent where a struggle took place. The autopsy confirmed he died of a self-inflicted gunshot wound elsewhere in the park. Officials say they have indicators as to what precipitated the attack, but are continuing to investigate. Palo homicide. Samantha Faith Bevins, 34, of Palo, and Tekoa Talley, 38, of North Liberty, face first-degree murder charges in the July 14th death of Jody Bevins, 58, of Palo. Samantha Bevins is Jody Bevins' stepdaughter. According to a criminal complaint, Samantha Bevins told investigators that Talley choked Jody Bevins while she suffocated her stepmother with a pillow on July 14th. Investigators found a note written by Samantha Bevins that had "Kill Jody" listed under that Thursday, according to the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation. Under the heading, they said, "We're still in this fight, and we continue this. I'm committed to fighting for Iowa to maintain its position on the nominating calendar." Ross Wilburn, chairman on the Iowa Democratic Party, on his party's efforts to remain first in the presidential nominating calendar. And, "Those are unconstitutional overreaches that have to be stopped, and they're stopped in court with a federal judge, and that's exactly what I aim to do as Attorney General." Iowa Republican Attorney General candidate Brenna Byrd on environmental regulations affecting agriculture. Under the heading Odds and Ends, Democrats in Limbo, Iowa Democrats said they're still dedicated to keeping Iowa first in the National Party's calendar for presidential nominations after the Democratic National Committee decided to hold off on deciding the calendar until after the midterm elections in November. The party was originally slated to decide the new calendar last week, but Iowa Democrats now have to wait 3 months for a decision. Mike Pence at Iowa State Fair. Former Vice President Mike Pence will make another swing through Iowa this month, planning to visit the Iowa State Fair, according to Politico. The Indiana Republican has made several trips to Iowa in recent months and is widely thought to be considering a run for president in 2024. Under the heading Water Cooler, CR Downtown Library closed. The downtown Cedar Rapids Public Library will be closed until September to clean and repair damage from a July 27th fire in a light fixture. COVID-19 cases dip, hospitalizations up. COVID-19 cases in Iowa fell slightly in the past week, but hospitalizations continued to rise. The state on Wednesday reported 5,768 new cases of COVID-19 compared to 5,924 new cases the week before. The number of people hospitalized with the virus increased to 309, up from 249 the week before. Under the heading More in the News, Grassley to support electoral count reform. U.S. Senator Chuck Grassley, Republican Iowa, said he would support a bill that would rewrite the 1887 Electoral Count Act and aim to ensure a peaceful transition of power between presidents. The bill would clarify that the vice president does not have discretion over the electoral results, raise the threshold for Congress to object to electoral votes, and clarify other procedures. Media sues Bettendorf. The Quad City Times and other media companies are suing the Bettendorf School District and school board after being barred from covering a May 25th meeting with 200 to 300 parents concerned about violence in the district's middle school. School employees were stationed at the doors of the Waterfront Center to keep reporters and photographers out. The lawsuit asked Scott County District Court to find the school district in violation of Iowa's open meetings law and to issue an injunction prohibiting the school board from violating the statute in the future. The lawsuit also asked the court to fine members of the board who took part in the meeting. New power lines. 18 new electrical transmission projects will wind through Mid-Continent Independent System Operators Midwest Subregion. 5 of those projects are planned either wholly or partially in Iowa. MISO's Board of Directors recently approved the $10.3 billion portfolio. It consists of more than 2,000 miles of power lines that should improve the power grid's reliability, cost-effectiveness, and resiliency. And discrimination settlement. A black administrative judge in Iowa who said her firing was because of her race agreed to a $225,000 settlement with the state and is in the process of being reinstated to her position. Renee Snitzer of Cedar Rapids was fired from her job with the Iowa Department of Corrections in 2017 for not adhering to a supervisor's orders, but in April, an administrative law judge found that the state did not provide just cause and ordered her reinstated. Turning to the Insight page, and first from editorial fellow Althea Cole, appreciating memories of the 2020 derecho, I think I knew even then there would be things I would want to look back on. The other day, I was tossing out some papers and came across a wrinkled notepad. I'm glad I flipped through it to see if there was anything I needed to keep. It contained all the little notes I jotted down in the days following the derecho on August 10th, 2020. It seems that everybody who experienced the derecho has their own derecho story. Mine began around noon that day when the sirens went off. Like a typical millennial, I don't have cable or local TV or even an AM/FM radio in my home. Instead, I'd looked at the radar on my smartphone, and since the weather app said rain in 36 minutes, I decided that I had plenty of time to hop in the car and grab lunch to go at a drive-thru 5 minutes away. That, my friends, was a bad idea. My mother, who called me right after the sirens went off to make sure I was home, is going to read this and say, well, duh. Instead of watching the storm from the comfort and safety of my sturdy brick home, I rode it out in my car, which I'd backed into my detached garage so I could see when the worst of it had let up and go back inside my home. It'd be 5-10 minutes tops, I thought, because even an intense thunderstorm doesn't really last very long, right? The following 45 minutes cured me of that assumption. I don't recall being certain that I was going to die during that terrified 45 minutes, but I also recall not being certain that I was going to live. Radar had stopped loading on my phone, and with winds like I'd never seen before, I'd begun to wonder if I was sitting in the path of a tornado. Growing more fearful by the second, I called a friend who I figured could tell me from the TV broadcast if a tornado was headed my way. "Oh, everybody's power is out," she said. "It's a big storm, but don't worry, it's not a tornado. It's just wind, just a lot of wind." My friend was right. It was just wind, just a lot of wind blowing at 120 miles per hour, ripping up our community. She stayed on the phone with me for those entire 45 minutes, talking me through my panic and listening to my every gasp and shriek and, oh my God, each time wind shook the walls of the garage or sent pieces of debris like roof tiles and soffits smashing into them. In hindsight, I'm amazed that nothing damaged my car. Overall, my homeowners association and I were pretty lucky, although some of us had it worse than others. In the very row of detached garages where I had taken shelter, several stalls in the end were destroyed, including the ones right next to where my 92-year-old neighbor, who still drives and had just returned from filling his gas tank, had also taken shelter. After the rain had cleared, we helped our neighbor who owned the destroyed garages salvage as much of her belongings from them as we could. Those were some interesting hours, days, and weeks in August 2020. Interesting enough that I wrote some of it down on a little notepad. Some of it was pretty trivial. Desperate for protein and limited in non-perishable options, I found out that Chick-fil-A sauce can really jazz up a packet of tuna, I wrote one evening. I must have been starving because that now sounds revolting. Some of the stuff I jotted down throughout each day so I could update out-of-town family later on social media. My brother Rob has a tree branch through his ceiling and his garage is destroyed with his car inside. He had just bought the house 2 months to the day earlier. The rebuilding of his garage is just shy of finally being complete. Some of the things I wrote down were jarring. Lost count of how many overturned semis I drove past on I-380, I wrote the day after the storm, following a trek down the interstate in search of gasoline. My search was in vain, but I did get to see how a local gas station in North Liberty was faring without electricity. Come and Go is operating cash only by writing sales in a notebook and adding totals with a calculator, I wrote. I told myself at the time I was jotting down my notes that it was just because I had nothing better to do to pass the time, especially in the dark. Read by candlelight, pee by candlelight, shower by candlelight, journal by candlelight, reads page 2 of the notepad. But I think I knew even then, in those days immediately following the most destructive storm Iowa has ever seen, that there would be certain things that I would want to look back on fondly. And there are indeed many things I want to remember. scrounging up deli meats and sharing a sandwich supper with neighbors, volunteering for a derecho recovery center to get food and supplies to people in need, standing at my screen door and squealing to the whole neighborhood that power was restored, my parents barreling through my door with every rechargeable device they owned not 20 minutes later. I also want to remember how happy we felt to see the convoys of utility trucks and how happy they were to be part of our recovery. Alliant Energy on its corporate Facebook page actually thanked Iowans for volunteering to do work crews laundry. That's the reality of a place like Iowa, during an incredibly stressful event in an already incredibly stressful year, while so many of us saw our homes and livelihoods lying around in tatters, we were all nice to each other. We fired up our generators, we picked up our chainsaws, we got to work, and we helped each other out. The derecho of 2020 has had a lasting impact on those whose homes and businesses were in its path. As our homes are repaired and rebuilt and the despair fades, we deserve to look back on everything we endured as a people and appreciate it. I hope our community never endures another loss like the one we experienced 2 years ago this week. But as to the act of coming together, checking in on our families every day, and bonding with our neighbors, I hope I don't forget that anytime soon. I wouldn't even mind experiencing it again. And Todd Dorman's column, 24-Hour Dorman, Lawsuit Ignores Rights of Trans Kids. So the battle over Linmar's efforts to support transgender students is headed to federal court. Parents Defending Education, a national organization working to reclaim our schools from activists imposing harmful agendas, according to its website, filed a lawsuit in U.S. District Court on behalf of seven parents living in the district. Linmar has a middle school and high school enrollment of more than 3,300 students. The parents aren't named in the petition filed this week because they fear retaliation against their kids by Linmar staff, community, parents, and students. Parents Defending Education makes its living intervening in local school disputes across the country. Also on its website, you'll find a map with red markers identifying problem school districts titled Indoctrination. The N is capitalized. Now it's arrived in my corner of Marion to save us from the scourge of making public schools safe spaces for transgender kids to learn. A sinister agenda, perhaps. The lawsuit argues the district's use of gender support plans violates parents' constitutional rights because they're not informed about the plan unless the student says it's okay. It also argues that provisions in the district's transgender support policies requiring students and staff to use the name and pronouns preferred by a transgender student violates the First Amendment rights of students who don't believe being transgender is a real thing. Unlike Florida, this would be a don't say they rule. The policy authorizes children to make fundamentally important decisions concerning their gender identity without any parental involvement and to then hide these decisions from their parents, the lawsuit argues. Parent A has a child on the autism spectrum, parent B has a special needs child, and parent C, who believes gender dysphoria is unlikely to persist past adolescence, has a child in a friend group with several LGBTQ students. They each fear Linmar will create a gender support plan for their student and not inform them. The petition argues autistic and special needs kids are more likely to identify as transgender or non-binary than other students. Parent D's child believes that people are either male or female and cannot transition from one gender to the other. Same with parents E, F, and G. They don't want their kids forced to use pronouns and names that go against their beliefs. The suit notes these kids have no ill will toward LGBTQ students. The parents want an injunction barring Linmar from enforcing its policy. The lead lawyer representing them is Alan Ostergren, who you might remember represented the Trump campaign when it sued rogue auditors in 2020 for sending out filled-in absentee ballot request forms. He led the legal charge to knock Democrat Abby Finkenauer off the U.S. Senate ballot. Reading the petition reveals a troubling thread that runs through its 30 pages. Being transgender is a problem. It's a problem for parents who fear their kids might question their gender identity. It's a problem for parents and students who can't accept the reality of being transgender. It's a problem for students who refuse to respect fellow students by using their names and pronouns. But it's an opportunity for conservative groups like Parents Defending Education to stoke outrage for political gain. What about the rights of transgender students protected under the Iowa Civil Rights Code and federal rules? The lawsuit makes no mention. Maybe they have the right to remain silent. It quotes Erica Anderson, a transgender psychologist who opposes allowing students to keep their gender identity confidential. She said school districts routinely inform parents of lesser matters, such as playground tussles and missing homework, but being a transgender student isn't a broken rule, a bad grade, or some sort of infraction. Telling students to not harass and denigrate their fellow transgender students in a way that's repeated and intentional, as the Linmar policy states, is not a crackdown on free speech. What if a student believes deeply that his classmates of color are here to replace white people, as conservatives such as Tucker Carlson claim? Does that student have a right to persistently and intentionally harass those students? Speech is free, but that doesn't mean there can't be consequences. The lawsuit cites the U.S. Supreme Court's ruling in Tinker v. Des Moines Independent School District, but in that case, students wore black armbands to silently protest the Vietnam War. They didn't repeatedly and intentionally bully fellow students. If students who can't accept the reality of being transgender have rights, why don't transgender students have a right to ask the school district not to inform their parents? They certainly know their home situation better than school officials. Why put kids at risk against their will? The district is confronting difficult situations that shouting parents' rights won't solve. Gender support plans are not some kind of punishment or scarlet letter. As the name implies, they offer support. No one is required to seek one. And even if transgender students don't ask for a plan, the supports remain in place for them. Why would parents not want their kids supported at school? Instead of marching into court, why not simply just support and respect transgender students? Let's allow them to go to a school where they can feel safe. Stop throwing them to the wolves, attacking our public schools, slapping pornography labels on LGBTQ books, and targeting students' rights. Stop trying to further marginalize already marginalized kids. This isn't about your fears, beliefs, discomfort, or politics. It's about their lives. And turning to the community letters and today's editorial cartoon, the editorial cartoon from Clay Bennett, syndicated cartoonist distributed by Counterpoint Media. It is labeled Kansas, the Sunflower State, and there's a drawing, a close-up of a sunflower, and within the black center of the sunflower, it says, Keep Abortion Legal. The first letter is from Mary L. Magner of Cedar Rapids. Good winners, losers make good citizens. Baseball season has wrapped up locally, and many of us have enjoyed watching our favorite little leagues and high school teams play. It's thrilling to watch kids who've struggled through long, hot practices and many games, complete with mistakes and losses, continue to play with gusto and confidence. We know they're learning something more valuable than catching or hitting a ball. We're grateful that their coaches and parents don't declare that their kids deserve to win before the game even starts, or when they lose, the adults don't holler that the game was stolen and accuse the winners of cheating, demanding the game be replayed. What a farce that would be. You win some, you lose some, but how you play the game is really all that matters. So much can be taught and learned via sports. Aren't we all thankful that our kids are learning how to be good winners and losers, and thereby good citizens? Would you want it any other way? Mary L. Magner of Cedar Rapids. Next, Ken Wetchen of Cathedral City, California writes, Hinson, Miller, Meeks are no Jim Leach. I read with interest the article on former Congressman Jim Leach. It reminded me of the reason I crossed party lines and voted for him when he was in Congress and I lived in eastern Iowa. Congressman Leach always put Iowa and the country above partisan politics. He took his oath to protect the Constitution seriously. The two women who now serve in Congress for eastern Iowa are more interested in demonizing Nancy Pelosi and telling lies to scare Iowans. They also voted against the infrastructure bill from which Iowa farmers are benefiting. Money is being spent on locks and dams from pork barrel projects, and bridges and roads are said to be improved with the infrastructure bill. These projects aid the farm-to-market roads and will improve bridges. Iowa leads the nation with the largest actual number of structurally deficient bridges, with 4,575. I moved to California to work part-time after retiring in Iowa. California is the home of both the majority and minority leader of the House. I am not a fan of either. I am more concerned about Representative Kevin McCarthy, the same Representative McCarthy who condemned President Donald Trump on January 7, 2021, about the attack on the Capitol, is now trying to whitewash the insurrection. Why is it always the future that never arrives for Republicans? Trump's health care plan, the pillow guy's breaking evidence, and Hillary's emails. Representatives Ashley Hinson and Marionette Miller Meeks are no patriots. Ken Wetchen of Cathedral City, California. Next, Mike Streb of Iowa City writes, Determining rights of unborn hard, necessary. Is abortion just a religious matter about which the government should steer clear? Roe v. Wade was not decided on the basis of freedom of religion, despite what many claim. The court majority in Roe ruled on the basis of an implied right to privacy under the Constitution. The Dobbs decision reversed that ruling, returning abortion to the legislative branch and the states. Lawmakers should not impose religious beliefs. However, they certainly can apply science to the question of whether and when to restrict abortion. An unborn child has a complete set of DNA, a sex, a blood type, and developing organs. A point is reached in pregnancy when the fetus can feel pain. A woman has rights, but so does an unborn child. Lawmakers must balance these rights, as difficult as that may be. A decent society does not tolerate having a healthy unborn child of a healthy woman ripped apart in the womb. Can we at least agree on that? Mike Streb of Iowa City. And Tim Bickle of Cedar Rapids writes, Biden hasn't learned how to say no. On a Tonight Show episode, President Ronald Reagan was asked his choice of an $80 million or $50 million deficit. Instead, he replied, I want a balanced budget. Host Johnny Carson asked, how? Reagan replied, it's just like protecting one's virtue, learning to say no. The Biden administration hasn't learned to say no. No to Green New Deal climate subscribers who rake in billions in government grants. No to abrupt solar replacement of fossil fuels. No to millions of illegal immigrants, criminals, sex traffickers, and fentanyl that's crippling our economy and killing our young. No to locking up oil and gas deposits under our feet. No to Chinese buying our emergency strategic oil reserves. Or no to $31 million Chinese funding for the Biden family. Every policy causes gargantuan gas prices, paper money hyperinflation, rising interest rates, and indeed real recession in this America Last agenda. We're killing our coal industry and capping our wells while begging our enemies for more oil, and while China is building 40 new coal plants. The elite demand quick transitions to $60,000 electric cars and solar equipment that depends on China's raw materials. Additionally, progressive leaders aren't saying no to killing preborn babies, reducing our black population by abortion three times other ethnic groups, or no to biological gender distinctions, nuclear family destruction, and dumbed-down education. The result, no virtue left to protect. America, with God's help and responsible citizen action, there still is hope. Stand up, speak up, and yes, vote. Tim Bickle of Cedar Rapids. You are listening to the reading of the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, August 7th, 2022, on the Iowa Radio Reading Information Service. I am your reader, Sharon Faltudo, and we turn to today's obituaries. Willard Nagel Sperry, known as Bill of Marion, aged 92, died Thursday, August 4th. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion, assisting the family. Donald E. Conaway, Jr., known as Don, age 74, of Cedar Rapids, formerly of Eagle Grove, Iowa, passed away on Wednesday, August 3rd, at his home. In agreement with his wishes, cremation has taken place, and there will be no services held at this time. Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service of Marion is assisting the family. Don had a love for Iowa and was a lifelong fan of the Iowa Hawkeyes. He participated in bowling, basketball, and softball while at Rockwell, and enjoyed golfing, couples tennis, and traveling. He will be remembered for his sense of humor and crazy wit, even if there was only one person in the room. Thomas Allen Parazek, 74, of Cedar Rapids, died Tuesday, August 2nd, at the Iowa Veterans Home in Marshalltown. A celebration of life service will be held at 4 p.m. Tuesday by Pastor Mark Thomas in the Monarch Room at Tien's with military honors. Friends not attending the service may visit with the family from 4:30 to 6 p.m. in the Monarch Room. Tien Funeral Home is serving the family. Tom had a deep passion for drum and bugle corps and was a member of the drum line with the Grenadiers. He worked for the Emerald Knights as an instructor and later became a DCI judge. He enlisted in the U.S. Army in 1966 and served in Vietnam with the 101st Airborne Division. After working for UPS for over 20 years, he started Air One Archery. He suffered a brain aneurysm in 1993 that changed his life forever. He was mad that he did not remember the helicopter ride to Rochester. He has resided at the Iowa Veterans Home since October 2019. Darren Lynn Court, age 54, of Loxton, South Australia, died Thursday, July 28th, after a fierce and courageous battle with pancreatic cancer. Funeral and burial will be in Loxton, South Australia. A memorial service will be held at 10:30 a.m. Friday, August 19th at St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Stanwood, Iowa, with Reverend Daniel Agnoski officiating. Darren was called to be a Lutheran minister in Loxton, South Australia, in March of 2006, where he had the pastoral care of Concordia Lutheran Church and four outlying congregations. Darren was intrigued and embraced the benefits of his new life. He chased red fox and kangaroo called spotlighting with local farmers. He loved a good campfire with his local parishioners, and he even tried a little surfing on the pristine beaches of South Australia. Darren was a wonderful cook and a proficient gardener wherever life took him. He always had a green thumb from the fertile soil in Iowa to the mountains in Colorado or the riverland in Australia. Louis Harold Langenberg of Lisbon was born October 29, 1932, and passed away peacefully at home on Monday, August 1, 2022. Getch Funeral Home has taken Louis and his family into their care. A celebration of life will be held later this fall. Carol Ann Bock Wolf, age 76, a small woman with a mighty soul, took her place in heaven on August 1, 2022, after a long struggle with congestive heart failure. No one who knew Carol would be surprised to learn that she was giving the ICU nurses fanciful names and making them laugh in the final weeks of her life. Carol's funeral will be held August 13th at Murdoch Linwood Funeral Home, 520 Wilson Avenue Southwest, Cedar Rapids. The visitation will begin at 9 a.m., and the service will be in the chapel at 10 a.m., followed by burial in the adjacent Linwood Cemetery. Visitors are requested to wear masks. After Carol's divorce in 1980, she stayed in Washington and worked at the Frontier Restaurant as a waitress. Eventually, she moved to Cedar Falls, Waterloo, and became a Home Shopping Network packer for 8 years. Forever the sportswoman, Carol pitched women's softball in Waterloo until she was 53 years old. When Home Shopping closed, Carol moved to Cedar Rapids and worked at Sedona Staffing Services and then Nordstrom's until she retired in 2005. Linda Lou Melota, 85, of Cedar Rapids, died on Saturday, July 2, 2022, at her home. Celebration of life, 2 p.m. Saturday, August 13th, at the Legacy Center at Murdoch Linwood in Cedar Rapids. Linda Lou worked for Killian's and then as a nursing aide at Kingston Hill in Cedar Rapids until her retirement. Linda loved reading and traveling. William L. Kennedy, known as Larry of Cedar Rapids, died on August 2nd after a brief illness. He was 88. Larry will be remembered by his family and his many friends and colleagues as a fair, generous man and a good soul. Larry was deeply involved in scouting. He received his Eagle Scout Award in 1947 and was involved in Boy Scout leadership for many years. Over the decades in Cedar Rapids, Larry worked with the Bezenson Whitehead Hoblitzel and Bennett Neighbor Kennedy Insurance Agencies. He retired from the West Bend Mutual Insurance Company as a regional marketing and sales representative in 1996. In retirement, Larry joined with Pat and daughter Catherine to form Rainbow Visions, an educational group that taught a message of mind, body, spirit, integration, and peace. A celebration of Larry's life will be held on Friday, August 12th at the Unity Center, 3791 Blair's Ferry Road, Northeast. There will be a reception for family and friends at 9 a.m., followed by a service of celebration at 10 a.m. Larry was a proud and active member of the Thursday Noon Optimists and the Unity Center of Cedar Rapids. In recent times, he was a dedicated English language tutor at the Catherine McCauley Center. Evelyn Louise Cassell, born Evelyn Louise Johnston, age 93 of Keystone, Iowa, died on August 5th at the Keystone Care Center. Funeral service is 10:30 a.m. Tuesday, August 9th at Hrabok Newhouse Funeral Service in Belle Plaine, Iowa. Burial will take place at National Cemetery in Vining. Visitation is 4 to 7 p.m. Monday, August 8th at the funeral home. Evelyn was employed by Vigortone Ag Products in Cedar Rapids until her retirement in 1994. Evelyn was the best mother, grandmother, and great-grandmother that her family could have asked for. She enjoyed knitting and crafts, making many items for her family and charity. Joseph A. Nassif of Cedar Rapids. There was a childlike countenance and sense of humor about Joe. He laughed, giggled some, and liked to tease. That was Joe in the later years of his life. He died happy and loved in the care of his family and compassionate caretakers. He was born September 15, 1951, and he died 70 years later on July 27, 2022, from complications of schizophrenia. After passing the bar exam, Joe became a member of the Iowa State Bar Association in 1982. He championed the rights of the underdog, abused women and children while working for the Muscatine Department of Family Services. In Linn County, he represented the elderly and also mentally disabled individuals. He also represented victims of employment discrimination, auto accident victims, and occasionally criminal defendants. Acting in politics from a young age, Joe worked on the campaigns of many Iowa politicians, including John Culver, Harold Hughes, Tom Harkin, and presidential candidate John Kerry. A burial mass was held on August 2nd and Joe was laid to rest at St. George's Cemetery next to his parents and siblings. Richard White, 58, of Lucerne, California, passed away on October 21, 2021. A celebration of life will be held from noon to 3 p.m. Saturday, August 13th, at 2435 Hanley Drive Southwest in Cedar Rapids. Edwin Dale Hrubes, age 84, of Henderson, Nevada, passed away on July 6th in Henderson following a sudden illness. Ed entered the U.S. Navy, serving in San Diego and the Philippines. Enjoying challenges, he moved his family to Anchorage, Alaska, to start wholesale and retail businesses while also pursuing her pilot's license. The family lived in Alaska for 10 years, then relocated to the Las Vegas area to work in the flooring industry, making numerous friends at the casinos as a trusted partner. Ed enjoyed following his family's athletic, academic, and professional pursuits and successes. A celebration of life will be held on August 20th at Green Valley Lutheran Church in Henderson, Nevada. A private family burial will take place at Southern Nevada Veterans Memorial Cemetery in Boulder City, Nevada. Charles Schlesselman, known as Dutch, passed away on July 26, 2022. He enjoyed a long 98 years of life filled with joy and adventure, including worldwide travels and summer trips to the family cabin at Separation Lake in Ontario, Canada. He owned and operated the Ranch Supper Club in Coos Falls, Victoria Inn, and Victor and Forum, Cedar Rapids. He was a member of the ATO Fraternity, Elmcrest Country Club, University Athletic Club, and was the longest living member of the Cedar Rapids Elks Club. A celebration of life from 2:30 to 4:30 p.m. August 20th at the hotel at Kirkwood, 7725 Kirkwood Boulevard Southwest in Cedar Rapids. Howard Slodick, 88, of Lee's Summit, Missouri, passed away peacefully Friday, July 29th. Funeral mass will be celebrated at 11 a.m. Monday, August 15th at St. Mark's Catholic Church, 3736 Lee's Summit Road in Independence, Missouri. Visitation will be held for 1 hour prior to the mass. Howard had a distinguished career with the Social Security Administration beginning in 1956, serving in the Kansas City region. During his tenure, Howard served in a number of capacities, including area director for the state of Iowa in Des Moines from 1974 to 87, and as the assistant regional commissioner in Kansas City, from which he retired in 1998. Eileen M. Fortman, age 93, of Ryan, passed away peacefully on Tuesday, August 2nd, at home with her favorite family members at her bedside after battling heart failure. Visitation for Eileen will be held 3:30 to 7 p.m. Monday, August 8th, with scripture service at 3 p.m. at Bonencamp Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Manchester. Mass of Christian burial will be held 11 a.m. Tuesday, August 9th, with additional visitation from 10 to 11 a.m. at St. Patrick Church in Ryan, with the Reverend Gabriel Anderson officiating. Burial will take place at Calvary Cemetery in Ryan. Bonencamp Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service is in charge of arrangements. Eileen was a member of St. Patrick Catholic Church in Ryan, an altar and rosary societies, Catholic Order of Foresters, and the Ryan American Legion Auxiliary. She loved the farm and gardening. Bob Farino of Anamosa, if a life is measured by good deeds and positive impact on others, Bob Farino lived an extraordinary full life for 70 years until our Lord called him home to heaven on August 1st. Bob made it his personal mission to help as many people as he could. Bob coached Little League with his father, Hank, and taught impressionable 5th and 6th graders at Carpenter Elementary School, who were recognized for excellence with Bob's Woofie Award. Bob also co-founded and wore innumerable hats for Starlighters 2 Community Theater, seeing his passion for theater come alive on the stage. Bob retired from teaching and joined Grantwood Area Education, bringing his formidable IT expertise to children and schools all over the state of Iowa. A mass of Christian burial will be held at 11 a.m. Saturday, August 13th at St. Patrick's Catholic Church in Anamosa. Visitation will be from 9:30 to 11 a.m. There will be a lunch served in the church basement immediately following the mass and an interment at Oakwood Cemetery in Monticello. Father Sean Smith will officiate and Deacon Bean will assist with the mass. Getch Funeral Home has taken Bob and his family into their care. Charles Clayton Nosley, known as Chuck, age 91 of Cedar Rapids, passed away on August 3rd at Boyson Heights Assisted Living. Services, private. Interment at Cedar Memorial Park Mausoleum. Cedar Memorial Park Funeral Home is in charge of arrangements. Chuck worked for 13 months on a survey team to select sites for constructing microwave radio relay links throughout the main island of Japan, When the Korean War ended in June of 1953, Corporal Nosley was discharged on December 31st, 1953. After graduation, Chuck accepted a job at the Chrysler Corporation Missile Division in Detroit, Michigan. When business started to decrease at Chrysler, Chuck took a position at Sunstrand Corporation in Rockford, Illinois. After his father passed in 1978, he returned to Iowa, where he was offered a position at Rockwell Collins and worked in various departments and retired in January 1994. He was initially a member of First Baptist Church in Marion and served 2 years as chairman. Later, he had joined Marion Christian Church and served for 2 years as chairman and several years as an elder. Irene Mae Mitz, age 92, of Claremont, Iowa, passed away Friday, June 17th at Good Samaritan Home in Postville. She was born May 19th, 1930, in Postville. She attended country school through 8th grade and graduated from Claremont High School in 1948. There will be a visitation from 9 to 11 a.m. Thursday, August 11th at West Claremont Lutheran Church in Claremont. Funeral service will be 11 a.m. Thursday, August 11th at West Claremont Lutheran Church in Claremont, Iowa. Interment will follow at God's Acres in Claremont. Niall Paul Hussman, age 80, of Center Junction, died Wednesday, August 3rd, with his wife next to his side. Services will be 11 a.m. Tuesday, August 8th at Wayne Zion Lutheran Church, rural Monticello, where friends may call from 9 to 11 a.m., with burial at a later date. Getch Funeral Home has taken Niall and his family into their care. Niall and Judy were members of St. John Lutheran Church in Olin for 49 years. When they moved to Center Junction, they joined Wayne Zion Lutheran Church in rural Monticello and have been members for the last 12 years. Niall raised cattle and farmed until they moved to Center Junction in 2010. He enjoyed being a little league baseball coach for many years and watched his sons and grandkids play sports. He was a member of the Lions Club and Olin Fire Chief for several years. He was a member of Jones County Ducks Unlimited with his good friend Martin Letaire. He enjoyed watching NASCAR and going to races with his boys from Wyoming. What goes on in Michigan or Chicago stays in Michigan or Chicago. Helen Marguerite Guinap, 94, of Urbana, died Wednesday, August 3rd. A visitation will be held from 4 to 7 p.m. Tuesday, August 9th, at Murdoch Funeral Home and Cremation Service in Center Point. A funeral mass will take place at 10:30 a.m. Wednesday, August 10th, at St. Mary Catholic Church in Urbana. Burial will follow at St. Mary Catholic Cemetery in Urbana. Helen worked as a CNA at Crestview Acres in Marion and the Good Neighbor Home in Manchester. After retirement, Helen and Donald managed multiple mobile home parks. She was a member of St. Joseph Catholic Church in Meesville, Minnesota, and St. Mary Catholic Church in Urbana. Church was very important to her. And Dr. Brianne K. Wakoff, age 43, of New York City, New York, died surrounded by her family and friends on Monday, July 25th, from a 9/11-related kidney cancer that was diagnosed in 2021. A celebration of life will be held at a later date. Turning to the sports page, my Colossus column, How Does Field of Dreams Game 2 Avoid Whiffing? Sequels are always tough to pull off, and Dyersville's MLB game is no exception. Sequels seldom are great. You don't catch lightning in a bottle twice. Do you remember the sequels for Slapshot or Caddyshack or Major League, just to name sports-related movies? For your sake, I hope not. Luckily, there has been no Field of Dreams 2 Revenge of the Ghost Players. We are getting a Field of Dreams sequel, however. It's a second edition of a Major League Baseball game, Thursday night in rural Dyersville. Like last year's affair, it's a tough ticket. Last week, StubHub's cheapest seat for the game went for $890. The most expensive was $5,200, making me wish I'd have at least entered the lottery to buy two face value tickets with fees for $826. If you build it, they will gouge. Virtually everyone who attended or watched the 2021 game was enchanted by the production Major League Baseball put on at the new Field of Dreams Stadium. Even those of us who thought pancakes would have been drowning victims from all the syrup in that movie found the live event enjoyable. That was as special and breathtaking a setting for a baseball game as I've ever been part of, New York Yankees manager Aaron Boone said. Kevin Costner leading players from the Yankees and Chicago White Sox out of the cornfield behind the right field fence and onto the playing field may sound like pure corn, but it was done well. It somehow was dignified instead of ridiculous. Then the game was played, and it added to the luster of the event. The Sox entered the game in first place in the American League Central, and the Yankees were the Yankees, with big boppers Aaron Judge and Giancarlo Stanton. Judge and Stanton mashed two-run home runs in the top of the ninth inning to lift the Yankees to an 8-7 lead. But Chicago's fiery Tim Anderson lined a two-run homer of his own in the last of the ninth for a walk-off 9-8 win and a cinematic ending. Some have suggested it was the most memorable sporting event ever to have taken place in Iowa. So let's do it again next year. Major League Baseball decided before the first one had even gotten started. How do you stage a sequel with the original still so fresh and hard to top in the public's mind? Sure, they'll try some new tricks. They better. This year's game isn't a clash of contenders for anything but the worst record in the National League Central. It's the Chicago Cubs and Cincinnati Reds, which means the star power on the field won't be enough to turn on the lights at the ballpark. The Cubs have ridded themselves of almost everyone from their Hollywood-esque 2016 championship season and are quite lousy after enjoying winning seasons from 2015 to 2020. The best thing you can say about the Reds is they're a franchise with a lot of winning history to recall, if you're old enough anyway. They haven't won a postseason series since 1995, the longest current streak in MLB. But nostalgia is what all things Field of Dreams is about, isn't it? Well, that and milking a cash cow. The New Yorker's Roger Engel, who died in May at age 101, wrote about baseball as well as anyone who has ever lived. He said the movie Bull Durham was just about perfect. He lauded a league of their own, but Field of Dreams? The stuff about the connection between baseball and American life, the Field of Dreams thing gives me a pain, Engel said in a Salon.com interview. I hated that movie. You look back into the meaning of old-time baseball, and really in the early days it was full of roughnecks and drunks. They beat up the umpires and played near saloons. In Field of Dreams, there's a line at the end that says the game of baseball was good when America was good, and they're talking about the time of the biggest race riots in the country and Prohibition. What is that? That dreaminess. I really hated that. How's this for a sequel? Or black or Hispanic player from the Cubs or Red Sox, Cubs or Reds, steps out of the batter's box, turns to the crowd, and yells, "They wouldn't have let me near a big league ballpark in 1919. That wouldn't necessarily be dreamy, but it sure would make a heck of a plot twist. And turning to the time machine, a look back at the people, places, and events in eastern Iowa. Unsolved CR murder. Dennis Chaffee was shot in his basement in 1983 while his twin toddlers were upstairs. By Diana Fannin Langton, correspondent. It's been 39 years, but twins Maria and Adam Chaffee hold on to hope that the person who killed their father in 1983 will one day be identified and brought to justice. The arrest of a Manchester man in 2018 for the murder of Kennedy High School senior Michelle Martinko, 39 years after her slaying, only deepened their hope, but they're still without answers. The twins were 18 months old and staying with their father, Dennis Chaffee, at his Cedar Rapids home when he was shot and killed. The Newsy Marion Sentinel chronicled the milestones in Dennis Chaffee's life. Born September 15, 1949, in Cedar Rapids, measles in 1953, infectious hepatitis in 1955, mumps in 1956. He was in the fourth grade in Hiawatha when he and four of his classmates led a discussion on safety and fire prevention in October 1958 on Youth Speaks, a radio series sponsored by the school district that aired on several local radio stations. Dennis was 11 and his brother Jack was 13 when they were featured in an August 18, 1961 Gazette story as Gazette carriers. Jack delivered 65 papers to Hiawatha businesses. Dennis had 97 customers on Robbins Road and Northwood Drive Northeast. Dennis was headed into 7th grade at Franklin, and Jack was going to be a 9th grader. The story said Dennis had a coin collection and liked model woodworking. The two boys are saving part of their earnings for college expenses, the story said. Dennis Chaffee was among the 717 students who graduated in the Cedar Rapids Washington High School class of 1967, the largest class to graduate in the city's history. The new Kennedy High School opened in the fall. 2 years later, Chaffee and 21 other young men from Linn County were drafted into the Army. After training, Chaffee served in Vietnam. When he returned home to Hiawatha for a 10-day leave in August 1971, 31 members of his family gathered for a picnic at the home of his parents, Harlan and Betty Chaffee. After his service, Chaffee worked at Wilson Foods. In 1980, he bought a two-story brick house at 914 38th Street Southeast. The house was set back from the street, surrounded by shrubbery, a fence, and large trees. Chaffee had his 18-month-old twin staying with him at his house the weekend of July 16, 1983. Mary Hernandez, the twins' mother, called Chaffee on Monday, July 18th, to arrange to pick up the kids. When he didn't answer, she called Chaffee's parents and asked them to go to the house and see what was going on. When the Chaffees arrived shortly after 8:30 p.m., the door to the house was closed but unlocked. Inside, they found the children dirty and thirsty but unharmed. Harlan Chaffee found his son lying at the bottom of the basement steps with at least 3 gunshot wounds. Police said little about the crime and were tight-lipped about possible suspects, according to the Gazette. A 1990 recap of unsolved murders in Cedar Rapids included Chaffee's death, quoting Assistant Police Chief Bruce Kern as saying, "No new leads have been generated of late." Chaffee's mother, Betty, was interviewed at the time and said she credited relatives, friends, and religion with helping her and her husband cope with their son's death. "We do make memorials to our church, but it's easier for me if I do it on other days than the anniversary of his death or his birthday. It just brings it home too much on those days," she said. Chaffee's mother died in 2000 and his father in 2009. Even though he was only 18 months old when her father was killed, Marie Chaffee said she wishes she could remember what happened in his home that weekend. "If only I could remember. Maybe my memories could bring justice for my dad," she said in an email. "I think how life would have been different with him in it. How am I like him? Do I look like him? Act like him? He's a big piece of me that I'll always be missing." She said her main heartache is for the family members who knew her father and had to go through life not ever knowing why he was killed. Someone got away with murder. And that brings me to the end of reading the Cedar Rapids Gazette for Sunday, August 7th, 2022. The articles have been selected and lightly edited by me, Sharon Falduto, reading to you from my kitchen table in Coralville. Remember that you can access a recording of this or any other IRIS recordings at any time on our website, iowaradioreading.org. We welcome your comments, and thank you for listening.